Oh, hey there, listeners and juicers. Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that if you have fallen in love with the Draw Your Dice podcast and want to help put some new fruit on the table, but don't feel comfortable making a monthly commitment, well, you can support the show via the Acast supporter feature. No gift too large, nor too small. Just click on the link in the show description and know that I am sending you the strongest hug when you do so.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Took a step back and I was like, the way that you fish isn't really like the fun here. It's like, what is your relationship to the queer gang? And like, how do we use the way you fish as a metaphor to say that? So like the rod and the reel, like,
my name is Jeremy Gage and welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. This is an educational show involving all things tabletop role-playing industry. Listen alongside me as we hear from creators, entrepreneurs, and supporters about their personal best practices, principles, and philosophies. I encourage anyone from the budding game designer to a seasoned publisher and everyone in between to sit down with us and enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. This is Jeremy Gage, as you heard in the intro, but as I say in every episode, it's not about me. It's about who I've brought to you today, and I am excited about who I've brought to you. We've been in communications for weeks. Weeks been setting this up. They are the publisher over at Riverhouse Games. They are the co-host of RSS Defiant. They are the host of Game Closet Podcast. I would like to welcome to the show Taylor LaBrèche.
Yay!
You were ready. You knew it was coming.
Hell yeah.
I love it. Welcome to the show, Taylor. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeremy.
As always, as I open these things off, for people who may not be aware of who you are, would you give a brief introduction of how you present yourself to the internet and any additional plugs? Because I can't guarantee that everyone will make it to the end of this podcast. So I want you to make money as soon as possible.
Hell yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you. So I am Taylor LaBrèche. I'm on Twitter at Leviathan Files. I have an extensive library of games that you can go and have fun with over at Riverhouse Games. Wow. Riverhousegames.itch.io. I am also the host of the Game Closet podcast. It's an informal chat show with all sorts of really amazing queer and LGBT plus folks in the tabletop RPG space. And then, like you said, I am also the co-host of the RSS Defiant. We are four friends with two missions. The first is to have fun, and the second is to objectively rank every single episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Yeah. Hell yeah. And I'm super excited. I am a fan of the Draw Your Dice podcast. A long-time listener, first-time guest. But yeah, and I think that it's like really cool to have shows like this, which is similar to my show Game Closet, where it's like these one-on-one conversations. And I think the thing that I get out of your show that I super love, that I hope people get out of my show, is the kind of like conversational nature of games being the mode of discourse that I like really enjoy and engage in. Because like, it's difficult for me to like read RPG theory and be like, yes, ludonarrative discourse, or like, any of these things. Like, it's not very accessible to me, even though I've been like doing games for 5 years, or like playing games for more than 20 now. But like, having, you know, face-to-face conversations, or like listening to people casually talk about things, is so much more of like a developmental boon to me than like anything else. So before we jump in, like, A, thank you for the opportunity to be on this show, but like, B, thank you for like this show, because it's super whips and I love it.
Super whips. I've never heard that before, and it's stolen. Yes. No, I feel very similar energies from the episodes I've listened for Game Closet so far. I feel the exact same way. Mm-hmm. There's this like barrier for me when it comes to more like traditional academia style learning, like absorbing through written articles or I mean, there's definitely a time and a place for reading for sure. There should be people that are reading every day, but I definitely like in an auditory way. I prefer learning, you know, I prefer audiobooks and things of that nature. And I also love the parsing of like simple explanation, because when you engage in a conversation with someone in this style of format, especially for our preferred industry or medium, excuse me, it helps with the level of understanding that, like, you know, I'm a 5-year-old. Tell me what I need to know. I can't use like ludonarrative discourse to absorb information, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I need it to be parsed down to me. And I think that you do a really great job.
Hell yeah. Thank you.
Of course. In addition to that introduction as an icebreaker for the guest, could you also share with us your sort of opening journey of, you know, what got you into the role-playing hobby and what games or discipline, however you want to coin it. Hobby sometimes makes it sound small, and that is not the case. It is an industry all its own. But what also was maybe the first game that sort of got you into thinking about game design or creating content in that space?
Yeah. So my answer changes like every year.
Perfect.
Because there is no concrete version of the self. So yeah.
Constantly fractal.
Yeah. I'm a big Walt Whitman fan. So, you know, the cliche of I am large, I contain multitudes is very true. But yeah, no, I learned to read very early on, because like my dad made it a big point to like read with me every night and like really encourage me to develop that skill. So I was reading from like 2 years old on, and starting in kindergarten, like anytime that I was like with other kids, like on the playground for recess or whatever, I would be reading to them. And the thing that we really loved doing was getting choose your own adventure books from the library. And I would essentially be like walking my friends through these choose your own adventure books. And because there is a finite supply of those books, and an even smaller supply at whatever, you know, school library you can access on any given day, we ran out after a short while. And so what I would do is I would bring a choose your own adventure book and pretend like I was reading from it, but essentially just like make up my own stories on the playground. And so that is like essentially how I got into like the act of doing this sort of like interactive storytelling gameplay stuff. And then so like fast forward a few years to like a summer orchestra camp, and you could see I have my bass behind me, like, so I bring that up because like music and like tabletop RPG stuff is always linked to me, just because I approach the way that I do both art forms kind of the same way, and because they both have like a similar start in my history, in that the summer orchestra camp after fourth grade, where I picked up the bass, is where like I really started to get into like the actual TTRPG side of things, where it's like, hey, you know, let's play Dungeons and Dragons. Let's play these games like with rolling dice instead of just like doing a choose your own adventure story. And picked that up and ran with it for like a good 15 years. And I was one of those people where I was like, I'm a nerd, so I can play Dungeons and Dragons, but I'm not that much of a nerd, so that's the only tabletop game that I play, which was a bummer. And I wish that I had broken myself out of that a long time before I did. So I played Dungeons and Dragons for way too long and started looking at other games kind of when I made it into college. The game that really like got me going, like, oh, I can do this. I have no clue what the game itself is actually called, but there's a podcast that was run by the now host of the One Shot Podcast Network, James D'Amato. And that podcast was called like Critical Theory or Critical Reads or something. It's no longer out. Like, he's not doing it anymore. But they ran a game design contest for one of James's friends, or like maybe there was an advertiser, I don't know, to say like, hey, make a character or make a class or a playbook or whatever for this game. And it was like a D10 percentage success skill, whatever game. And I looked at that. I was like, oh, I really love this podcast. Maybe I'll like do this design thing. And so I made a playbook that was based off of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I used brand language from those stories, and so my submission was rejected outright. And I said, hey, you know what? Screw you. I'm going to do this for real now. And I started writing my own games. So yeah, very long, rambling story that culminates in a moment of spite. But it's a very positive, like, momentum-building moment for me.
Well, first of all, not a ramble, and I always love long answers.
Yes.
You know that, being a fan of the show.
Yeah.
We like long here. Yeah, I love that sort of, when my brother and I were, I want to say 3 and 5, my brother's 2 years younger than me. Mm. We learned to read through video games. We didn't learn to read through books because at the time, that's when things like Final Fantasy VII had just come out. We were playing games like Saga Frontier, yay for the remaster. But like PS1 and N64 and Super Nintendo were like how we taught ourselves to read because we wanted to understand what was happening in the game. So all the dialogue boxes and stuff like that. And our mom was a very like hardworking woman, was always gone for like 12 hours of the day, and our dad was sort of like entrepreneurial and ran a lot of like self businesses, so it wasn't as, we did like homeschooling and things like that, so a lot of our own learning was by us, but we were also very like young readers in the sense that we were kind of always ahead of our grade based on like the language that was filled in video games intended for like 14-year-old and higher demographics. So I totally relate to games being sort of my first reading space. And the music in RPG, I also wanted to comment on. Like, music is such a powerful component for play. It's such like a ritualistic thing, and it's such an atmospheric concept. I recently started watching Fantasy High by Dimension 20 with Brennan Lee Mulligan. And in spoilers for Fantasy High, if you are watching it, but there's this sequence. For the first time, Brennan is sort of playing with the idea of nightmares and like fear induced in the characters. And they're, you know, the show's very like classically bitty and kind of meta breaking. And I love it. It's so funny. It's a bunch of comedians just like going in at it. But there is a sequence where one of the characters is in like this tent and they start having a nightmare. And there's this like creepy figures kind of like stalking them in the shadows of this small, small single person tent. Like its face is just obscured by a flap of the entrance of the tent. And there's just like this big ominous music that's been playing for like four minutes or something like that. And you can tell he's waiting. He's staring at the player and like his hand is like in some sort of position. I think he has like a laptop or something that controls the music behind there. But he's waiting, waiting, waiting. And the second she finally like engages in role play to contact, like to yell out to an NPC, he cuts the music. He's like, you know, if you look at this thing's face, something very bad is going on. And all the other players are just like in that, the silence is so loud for them. So it's such a powerful, I think there needs to be more consideration for like playlists on Spotify and stuff that like really set the mood for specific RPGs. So I love that. I love that that's been a part of your younger life. And I also love that you chose to game design because someone you looked up to was like, hey, here's a thing I'm doing. Everyone sort of make a thing for you. Like, cool, I can make a thing for this. I've been checking it out for a while. And then when it was rejected, like, fuck you, I'm still making this thing. I'm still putting it out there. I love that energy. Fight to the power. Stuff in the air. Shaking.
Hell yeah.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that, Taylor.
Hell yeah.
So talk to me a little about, because we're going to get into one of the games, but initially I'd love to talk about sort of River House Games, the sort of game design company you've set up as a front for your content production, and just the principles behind that, because you sort of say it outright in the slogan of the website and on the Itch page. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about queer tabletop role-playing games.
Yeah. So Riverhouse Games, Riverhouse is an actual place. For a couple years, my friends rented a house on the Mississippi River in Minneapolis. And so, you know, that was always like a space that was before really the majority of my friend group had like a house. So everyone was in apartments before then. And this was the first like house that someone owned in our social group. And so it was kind of like the connecting point. Like everyone would go to the River House to like do their parties or to like watch movies or to hang out. And it was a group that I like started playing games with. And then as I started developing games, like would test them out. So we'll talk about this is a game about fishing. Like the first time that we ever that game was like ever played, or like the early playstorming sessions of that, were in the River House. And actually the picture of a river on the iTunes like logo icon for Game Closet is the view from the backyard of that house. So it's very special to me, like the advent of my journey in this like artistic endeavor, which is why I named like my game entity after that. Yeah. And I think that the more and more I like do game things in this sphere, the more I think about like the emotions that I had starting that. Like, what are the things that were in the River House that I want to impart on my game design ethos or the way that I run the business? And I, you know, again, always fluctuating, always changing. So like in a year, I might have a different opinion than this. And I certainly now have a different opinion than I did a year ago. But like, I'm really trying to go back to some of those things. And, you know, I've hesitated saying like the game design industry or like my business here, because like right now I'm trying to like really aggressively demonetize my experience in this space and like separate what I'm doing with games from like being a business, or like, you know, producing a product that is then purchased, or like really kind of like upholding anything here. So like right now, I think for Riverhouse Games, it's very much an ethos of like, these are games and experiences that are important to me as the designer, that I hope are important to you as the reader or the player. And they're going to happen according to my schedule of maintaining my mental health. They're going to happen according to, you know, a timeline of inspiration. Like the river is going to twist and turn, and it'll end when it ends, and it'll twist when it twists, and it will rush when it rushes. And like, I'm not going to try and force that. And yeah, I think that like, again, looking at how I view my presence in this space, like that's very much like the attitude and energy that I'm trying to bring to anything that I do.
That's really cool. I just so that, you know, it's about removing the weight of business from the design principles of what you're making, right? You're not making for the demographic. You're hoping that the experience that you are translating to your personal brand is the thing that attracts people to give you support for these creations, right?
Yeah, and sort of. I think it's less so the, like, who I make for and about, and it's more so, like, the relationship that I have to, like, what is a customer in the tabletop RPG space? Like, I don't want customers. I want people to, like, come and play my games and be moved by the art that I create. And I think long-term, I would be really overjoyously happy if I didn't have to rely on any money coming in from it. Because then I would just be able to say, like, here's what I do. If you want to give me money, great. If you don't, you know, that's also great. Because, like, the thing that I'm really trying to avoid is, like, anyone who's worked retail knows that there's an entitlement to a customer. Like, with a capital C customer. And I had a really, really disgustingly bad experience with Kickstarter that I ran for one of my games called The Treasure at the End of This Dungeon is an Escape from This Dungeon and We Will Never Escape from This Dungeon, where I had one of my backers sending me really nasty messages on a very frequent basis, like, hey, why isn't this out yet? Like, you need to be sending more updates. And, like, sure, yeah, like, I'm not sending updates every month because, like, I'm not going to just say, like, hey, we're working on it, or hey, I'm waiting for people to get back to me. And so this person, you know, clearly had a different expectation for what the experience was going to be out of this Kickstarter. And, like, it got to the point where they were leaving comments on the page and being like, you know, hey, this person's sketchy, they're not doing anything, clearly, like, just the worst behavior that a human being could do. Like, and I will say, like, again, like, they, with an asterisk on us, like, they weren't being, you know, bigoted, they weren't, like, calling me homophobic slurs or whatever. They were just being like an overly entitled customer. And they started talking about personal details of my life. Like, they were following my Twitter and like getting way too involved. I went to Kickstarter support and they were like, there's nothing that we can do about it. He's not breaking our TOS, even though clearly in the terms of service, there's like 10 different things that he's doing that he's not supposed to. So yeah, I shut everything down. I like went unlocked on Twitter. I made a personal account and it like really was this crystallizing moment of me being like, I don't want to do any of this, even if it's not like to this extent. Like, I don't want to have like someone, I don't want to have a good customer, you know? I don't want to have customers, period. I want to be able to make the games that I make and have people engage with them in a way that doesn't set those entitlements in their minds in the first place.
Do you think that that is an advent of the Kickstarter space as far as it connects to tabletop games? Or do you feel that's sort of like just a common, you know, in relation to games, you think that's just a common capital C customer thing that you experience on maybe like itch2 or a personal website or anything like that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that Kickstarter exacerbates the problems, but like I think that it's really going to be the, like I said, like I don't want to have a customer, like whether that's on itch, whether that's on Kickstarter, whether that's on like my Patreon, although I think my Patreon is the best example of the customer creator relationship that I've seen so far, in that I have a relationship with my patrons where they just like give me a small amount of money on a regular basis that then adds up to like covering one or two of my bills, and they get everything that I make. Like all of my patrons get early access to Game Closet episodes, and depending on what level you back at, you either get the full like the text of every game that I make, or the, like the fully laid out PDFs of everything. And like, I literally had a great interaction with one of my patrons where they upped to a higher tier, which would have given them like some extra stuff. And I was like, hey, thanks for jumping on. Like, thanks for bumping this up. Do you, you know, what can I do for this level? And they were like, don't worry about it. Like, I just did it because I could. You live your life. And like, that's the ideal interaction if money's involved in my game process, which again, like long term, I don't want it to be.
Right.
But at the same time, my day job doesn't pay me enough to like cover all of my bills and let me have a like a comfortable amount of money to spend on things. So yeah, I think it's, to be long, and again, we like long on the show, like to come around full circle, it's like I don't want to have a customer interaction. I don't think that it's specific to Kickstarter.
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, I have worked in restaurants for a decade of my life, and there's just this thing I can like, this is maybe slightly weird, but like I can smell it on a person.
Yeah.
I can smell the privilege coming off of a person the second they walk in a door. I don't know if it's like just the training I've had being tableside service, but it's always the person who screams like, I'm going to tell all of my friends that this place has such poor service and you've lost a big chunk of your revenue. I'm like, have I? It's that goddamn TikTok.
Yeah, exactly.
Extreme music. It's like, really?
Tell them.
Go tell them.
I'll tell them.
Yeah. I don't want your crab ass friends here anyways.
Yeah.
And I think there's definitely some energy in that of like, especially like, I think, like you said, exasperated by how Kickstarter sort of uses its language to talk to the people who are supporters of projects, and that they are the catalyst for success for a creator. And that really like warps people's perceptions of how a piece of content, product, service is executed upon by the individual who is giving you that, right? Like, it's the same as like, do you really know what goes back on in the kitchen? I, as your server, have no control over the temperature at which you cooked your food, but I'm the only person you can yell at.
So I
just think there's this invisible wall where they think automatons are creating product and the only human connection is the error in that thing. Yeah, I totally agree that there's a methodology, and it exists out there for sure. I mean, as you just talked about, a great experience with Patreon, but there is definitely a way to separate yourself and control sort of the demographic, and also I think what I'm trying to point out here for anyone listening who may be sort of new to this, I don't want to say self-confidence. That's not like the right word. For lack of a more refined term, like this self-confidence within yourself to say no to, like, I don't care. You know, I will, there are people out there who care about me. There are people out there who will support me, whether that be close social relationship, intimate relationship, parasocial, whatever have you. But they like what I'm doing. They like what I stand for. They like that I don't make for them. I make because this is an expression of who I am, right? Because game design is still an art form at the end of the day, right? Mm-hmm. So I definitely think there's, I mean, Tracy Barnett is a really great example of people who are like crushing that side of just designing for themselves, putting something out and say, hey, pay me whatever you want. You can have all my games. Mm-hmm. I don't give a fuck. And yeah, I think that's really cool that you're moving in that direction, and I'm here to support it. I'm here to give it all and tell everyone to go fuck off if they want to be a capital C here. I broke my own PG-13.
I'm glad that you brought up Tracy though, because like I have endless respect for the people who can, like, because like here's the thing about I love Tracy so much. Mm-hmm, they were the project manager for Descent into Midnight, which is like the biggest game that I've ever worked on. Mm-hmm. They were the project manager for the Kickstarter for that. And like, we literally would not have even come close to being as successful as we did without their help. But like, Tracy has such a genius mind about like the project management and like the, not administrative, but like the like behind the scenes stuff of like games. So the fact that they can do all of the game design that they're doing and make it look so casual to the outside observer, like, it boggles my mind. Like, I do not have those skill sets. So I wanted to make sure that I took a moment to be like, there's so much work that Tracy's putting into all of this. And still it appears that they're doing it in a way that's healthy for them. So like, I think that's the magic thing. 'Cause like, if it was healthy for me to like do project management for my games, to like really get into the business side, I would be doing it. Like, I don't want to be a year behind on this Kickstarter, Mr. Dude who messages me every week. Like, I don't, neither of us want me to be in this position right now. But like, it took me 5 years to recognize that and like start to demonetize and like de-business my space here. And like, another thing that we haven't even touched on is like, there's privilege in me being able to do that. Like, this isn't my day job. Like, I'm not, like, there are people out there for whom this is their food on the table, roof over their head income. And I'm lucky enough that I don't have to do that, because I've proven over 5 years that I'm PG-13. I'm
you can say it. No, do it. Give me the F.
I'm fucking crap at it. Like, it's horrible. I don't like doing it, and I'm not good at doing it. So I'm not going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the other thing, too, is to consider, like, if, you know, obviously not for you specifically, Ted, but for anyone who, like, is in the same boat, but they still want to do this as their means to an end, like, figure out how to work in a project manager like Tracy, who can help support, like, form a support team that can give you the leverage to be creative, 'cause game design is still a part of the work that takes time, energy, creative flow, like resources. We, you know, an indie game designer wears a ton of hats, but I think there's a consideration for, like, when you start to think about business things, also consider, like, can you work with a team? Do you need a team, right? If you're a person who's not good at project management, hire Tracy. If you aren't a good editor, or if you feel like you need some other eyes on it, hire people like Will Yopes or Adam Bass, right? Like, any of those creators out there are people who are able to be support systems. Hire visual layout people like Clayton Notestein or Nevin's partner Jam, like Dino Barry Jam over on Twitter. Like, I'm doing a total like pitch for people right now. But I'm saying there are people, there are definitely people out there. Even there is a tax consultant for specifically for game designers and game creators out there who understand like what they're looking at and can help you find tax breaks in places that you may have never considered, because art mediums are a hard thing to like wrap your head around taxes wise. So like, find the support system if you want to. They are out there, and you should definitely form it if it's something that, you're considering. Mm-hmm. Great, great listener. So your experience, what is your, before we get into this game is about fishing, kind of to finish talking about Riverhouse games as a general whole, what experience are you trying to translate through your games? What are you trying to express to people through your designs recently, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's evolved over time, but what are your more recent principles or experiences in the games that you're trying to capture? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it is that, like, the two word summation on the, you know, my website that I haven't touched in forever, like weird and queer. Like, I want games mm-hmm. that are weird, and I want games that are queer. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes those go kind of hand in hand, like, again, keeping it PG-13, but I do have a more adult game called Let These Mermaids Touch Your Dick Maybe, which is like a game about, like, how do you have conversations with your friends about, like, what you think is sexy. And it, like, I won't go into detail about that game just in case, you know, there are any PG-13s out there, but like, it's a game that, like, it doesn't feel like a game, and mm-hmm. and it certainly should not feel like it's straight. Like, short aside on that, like, there's still I think maybe the thing that, like, really broke in my mind, like, I don't need to make everyone happy, was someone on Board Game Geek wrote a very scathing review of that game with mm-hmm. the assumption that I was a straight man. And, like... like, sure, like, if you're reading that game as if me, the author, am straight, it's not great. But if you're reading it being like, wow, this is a gay guy talking about how much he wants to be gay, then that's where I think it sings. So, like, yeah, it's really about, like, how do I push myself in terms of, like, being weird and being queer. Mm-hmm. I've also 2 years now run the Not a Game Jam Game Jam, which, mm-hmm. like, going way back to the start of the show, like, if I can make something out of spite to be like, no, no, F you, I think that that's a useful energy. And so every year for those game jams, I really encourage people to be like, make a game that pisses off that person who, like, calls your games not games, you know? Like, mm-hmm. do it because they said that it wasn't. And there's a lot of that kind of, like, running through a lot of the games in Riverhouse. And I feel like right now, the games that I've really written kind of in pandemic, I have 30 games up on the itch.io, really only two of them in the last year. Like, I've slowed down so much in the pandemic. But the two mm-hmm. games that I've written recently, Machine Gun, which is based off of the jazz album of the same name, and These Jellyfish Aren't Real, which is based off of an assignment that I got in my college ethics class. Both of those are things that I'm, like, frustrated about, one more serious than the other. Machine Gun is, like, I'm very frustrated at people who are like, I don't know how to play this, or, like, I don't know what to do in this moment in games. Cause, like, I've been playing games for more than 20 years. And, mm-hmm. you know, again, I can recognize someone's experience is different than my own, but, like, I mm-hmm. fundamentally don't understand, again, because I've been doing this for 20 years and my experience is not going to be different than others, but, like, it's still kind of weird to wrap my head around not knowing what I want to do in a game, or being like, mm-hmm. I don't know how to, you know, these mechanics, I don't know how they match up, or, like, I'm mm-hmm. lost. And to take it back to my analogy of music, it's like, if you don't know what to do when you're playing a song, like, the album Machine Gun is a wall of sound. It's an octet of jazz musicians who just go into the booth and make an atrocious wall of noise. And it's like a middle finger to, like, any sort of, like, hesitation in improvisation. And so mm-hmm. for Machine Gun, I asked the players, like, here's a list of rules, and depending on how fast your GM can look up the music to Machine Gun by Peter Brotzman and the quartet or the octet, you can read through however many rules, but at the end of the day, like, you're going to be screaming. Like, this is the game where you just make noise to, like, get that out. Like, and you're gonna feel frustrated mm-hmm. at certain points because, like, you don't have all the rules. You're gonna feel, like, lost because, like, you're not looking to do something that you're used to do, but, like, I want you to just make noise. Like, the game tells you, mm-hmm. if you don't know what to do, just shout, because, like, you don't need to know how to play this game in order to play it. And then Jellyfish Aren't Real is a game that is based off of like a thought experiment in ethics where, you know, you're supposed to imagine yourself walking past a lake and you see someone who's drowning. You obviously go help them. But what if you're walking past a lake and you see someone who's drowning, but you're in a hurry to go renew your car registration? Do you still help them? You know, I would say yes. And then that thought experiment is like, keep adding details to find out when you say no. And I guess like to, yeah, and it's used, right, exactly.
It's making me think right now.
Like if you're trying to get to the hospital to see your grandfather who maybe has 5 minutes left and you see this person drowning, do you stop and help them? Like it's supposed to find those extremes to say like, what responsibilities do we have to other people? And then abstract that out to be like, so if you said that, you know, you would stop to help someone who's drowning if you were just trying to get home from the grocery store. Well, there are people out there who are drowning. It just doesn't look like they're underwater. Like, why don't you why don't you stop and give money to homeless people on your way home from the groceries? Because, like, they're struggling for their life. It just doesn't look like it to you. And it's supposed to argue, like, that we should be doing more as a society to help the people who are struggling. And so these jellyfish aren't real. It was written kind of in the early days of the 2020 election to say, like, you know, we shouldn't be looking to see who is the candidate with the most harm reduction. We should be looking to see the candidate who can do the most to save the people who can. And it was my frustration about people who were really trying to argue for Joe Biden over Bernie Sanders or other candidates on the basis that, you know, for whatever political basis. And so that's, you know, those are the things that I'm looking at in terms of like my game design now to say like, what do I want to create and like, how can I express these things that I wish people knew about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Processing a lot here. No, I love it. I love that I'm processing a lot. For Machine Gun, just to touch on that for a moment, for how it sort of relates in my mind is I'm a big like fail faster sort of person. Like, fuck it up, do it messy.
Absolutely.
Because if you don't do it messy, you'll never do it. Like, because it's gonna be messy.
Yeah.
Like, if you can't consider doing it a messy bad way, you'll never achieve like the perfect wrinkly brain perfect way, right? Like, it's just not gonna happen because you lack the experience, you lack the knowledge, and you lack the trial and error that comes with building a skill, building knowledge, building relationships, building really anything truly at the end of the day. And you know, there are best practices, but even if you learn all of those, you know, these hands don't know how to sew. So I can look up all the sewing videos in the world, but the second I start trying to figure it out, I'm probably going to prick myself 10,000 times. You know what I mean? So I am in a similar headspace of like when people, I think the more direct thing when it comes to games is that it's that loss of the child inside sort of thing when you're playing games. Like, you feel embarrassed or hesitant because you're not sure what the right, like, move is here to improv or to execute gameplay, right? In a way that doesn't cause you shame or guilt. And I'm here to say, tell you, just play the game. Just play, right? Figure out what the rough parameters are. And then just roll with it. I think people are willing to help you too. Mm-hmm. Like, I like to be the person at the table that like role plays extra hard just so some other people will role play, right? Like, I'll contort my face, I'll put on a really rough voice, and I'll just start screaming. And everyone's like, whoa, dude, chill. Yeah. And I'm like, hey, how about you hype up?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Release, dude. So Machine Gun is very cool. I love that conceptually and experientially.
Yeah.
As far as jellyfish, the jellyfish aren't real. I love that you are producing something that talks about thought experiments that kind of go that aren't challenging enough for people. Like, I think people thought experiment all the time, mm-hmm. right? We talk about help hypotheticals with our partners, with our loved ones, our intimate relationships, our personal relationships, our parasocial Twitter relationships, twitter.com. But they aren't always challenging. They're always like the safe mm-hmm. conception, right? And I love that this one specifically talks about, like, are you going to help a person who's struggling? Mm-hmm. What are you willing? It's kind of like also examining like opportunity cost type mm-hmm. things. Like, what are you giving up by, like, the grandfather examples? Like, it's probably going to take you 5 minutes to save this person. Mm-hmm. Is that something you're willing to exchange, right? Because mm-hmm. one thing I think is important to note about that sort of theoretical is that you're giving something up to do something else. Mm-hmm. For me, like, I would. My grandfather lived a long life. I got to hang out with my grandfather for 89 years. Mm-hmm. And yes, it will suck that I will miss these final 5 minutes. But this person, we don't know how old this person mm-hmm. is, right? Who's struggling in this hypothetical child, an adult, whatever have you, another person who may have five more years mm-hmm. unless you walked by, right? Are you going to trade 5 seconds for 5 years? I think that's how I look at mm-hmm. it. So it is. It's very cool. Mm-hmm. It's very, very cool. And I think it's something that I see a lot in, like, lyric games as well. I see it in even some, like, LARP games that I've been exposed to. Like, really these more challenging thought experiments of, like, what are you willing to consider mm-hmm. here with us today? Like, even in a group, right? Like, some of these games are solo, but some of them are, like, group play. And it's like, hey, we're all making this decision to, like, walk by this person. Mm-hmm. Are we all still cool with? And yeah, I just, it's good. It's real good.
Hell yeah. Games are good. Games whip.
Yeah. Second time. He'll be embedded. Definitely weird and queer. I'm here for it. Let's segment ourselves over into actually talking about and digesting one of these games. Let's talk about this game is about fishing. This is a game about fishing. Yeah. So why don't you, because you'll do a way better job since I already fucked up the title. Why don't you give a brief premise synopsis of the game?
Yeah. So This Is a Game About Fishing is a game that I've been working on that has taken many different incarnations over the years that I like to say it's like doing a kickflip over doing a sick kickflip over the curb. But instead of a skateboard, it's a shad wrap. And instead of a kickflip, it's crime. And instead of a kerm, it's the erosion of our ecological systems brought on by capitalism. Yeah, yeah. So it's a very stylized game that is essentially just like, hey, a dozen people like killed the world. Like, there are 100 billionaires who are responsible for climate change. They all have names and address. And like, sometimes you just need to go put a wrench in their window. Mm-hmm. But if I wrote a game being like, hey, go put a wrench through Jeff Bezos's window, A, that would end me up on a lot of watch lists. But then, like, B, I don't think that that's a satisfying experience to do. Like, yeah, it's cathartic to just be like, yeah, screw you. But, like, for me, the more I stylize it and the more that I make it, like, a fun experience to do and play, the more that I think, like, I can impart some of those feelings, you know, like I don't want to be quote unquote mean. I guess my personal philosophy is that you can't be mean to billionaires no matter what you do, because everything is justified. But I think if you can like set it up as like almost like this rocket power-esque, to use a Nickelodeon 1990s reference, if you can like be like a gang of queer youth like going and running and like rescuing fish from like people, because like the general conceit of the game is like, It's in the near future following ecological collapse, and now, like, for the most part, 90% of the Earth's fish species are extinct, mm-hmm. and the people who keep fish are, like, the rich elite. So you, like, go up and you rob these rich people, like, you steal their fish, and you can, like, either bring them to, like, wildlife ecological groups or, like, do whatever, you know. It's this very, like, heist, like, queer youth heist ensemble games.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, I when I first started, like, the first pass mm-hmm. I did of it, I was like, wait what is happening? And then the second pass, like, oh, I definitely get it, because I am big on like solar punk mm-hmm. like aesthetics. I'm big on like hope punk and eco punk and things like that. So I was really excited to like sort of chew on this game. And what I like that you were talking about is that, you know, you could have been really heavy-handed mm-hmm. about what you were trying to say here, right? Mm-hmm. But I think there is an enhanced effectiveness in making something that is a little bit more easily parsed by a random player, right? Some people may not have context for like who Jeff Bezos mm-hmm. is, because that's a possibility, right? No access to the internet or whatever have you. They don't use Amazon, which is hard to believe, but it is it is true. I have met those people. And there is something about like there I've spoken with some other creators on the show, Adam Bell with Reliance, also Adam Bell with Grasping Nettles, mm-hmm. And No Stone Unturned. A lot of those games have things to say about the environment, about taking down the current status quo and the means in which you do that. And without like relating to current events or current personalities, it is.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Letting you, it's a thought experiment, mm-hmm. right? It's another theoretical of like, hey, if the world ended up in this way, like our real world, what choices would you make again, right? Are you going to sell the fish to help establish those powers, mm-hmm. right? Are you trying to save what's left of this dying world? Are you trying to restart the dying world, right? Are you trying to help those eco-environmentalists re-establish the fish population? Mm-hmm. We need fish, people.
Yeah.
Soon there will be more plastic than fish in the world. I'm here to say that. Yeah, we need to do it. We need to do the damn thing. So play this game. Yeah. I don't know what to tell you, but you got to figure it out. You got to get woke. Yeah. But yeah, I love it. I love how it's delivered. I think there's a lot of really cool, like, fun language. I think your like authoritative voice here in the, or not even really authoritative, just like, hey, this is the way the world is. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's an old codger rocking in a chair, like remembering the last 60 years.
Yeah.
And like, hey, you whippersnappers, you do what you gotta do. I remember back in my day, I blew up an entire billionaire's warehouse just to get these fish back out into the ocean. Yeah. So I think that's all very cool in the sense of like how your challenge to current status quos is being delivered mm-hmm. to people. And there's a space and time for heavy-handedness. I don't want to be the person that's talking about like always deliver the soft version of your theories, like, because that's not always helpful. Sometimes you really need to be heavy-handed. I think you do a really good mm-hmm. mix is what I'm really like rambling towards, is that you do a really good mix of like, hey, just do what you believe in. Like, and you'll figure out what's right for you, and that will help speak volumes to other people. So really, really cool work there. As far as like constructing the playbooks and sort of like trying to capture a narrative in this, what were you trying to capture? What were like some of the tropes or touch points that you were trying to get to the player's mind in this experiential game?
Yeah, I think that that is a big question. It's a good question because so the playbooks all are around like a different kind of fishing, at least to start with. Like you have your rod and reel, you have the like different ways, like the rod and reel, then the net, like the crafter. I'm trying to remember like the playbooks that are in there now because like it's gone through so many iterations just because I'm never happy with it. And I started with that and just being like, oh, well, it's just the different types of the way that you fish. But then I like took a step back and I was like, the way that you fish isn't really like the fun here. It's like, what is your relationship to the queer gang? And like, how do we use the way you fish as a metaphor to say that? So like the rod and the reel, like when you fish with a fishing rod, like your strategy is all about like planning. Like you need to know where you're fishing. You need to, for the most part, have the right gear. You know, obviously you'll get success, you know, with whatever you use, but there are ways to like really optimize how like you can catch a fish with a rod and a reel and a lure. Like, do you want to go top fishing? Like, what kind of rig are you tying? Like, are you using bobbers? Are like the length of your reel, the material it's made out of, all these things go into like what kind of fishing you're going to be able to use. Like if I'm standing on the shore and fishing, it's going to be a lot different setup than if I'm like on a boat trawling. And so the rod and the reel is definitely like the person who's there to like set up things, to organize, to inspire others, to like to lead. And then if you look at the knuckles, which is based off of a practice in the knuckles is based off of a type of fishing that's really popular in the Appalachian Mountains, and it of like finding catfish holes and sticking your hand in them and like ripping the fish out. The knuckles is like my favorite because they're really boisterous. They're all about like the community and the celebration of fishing. And I am going to put an image into our Google Meet chat here that anytime I need to like work on this as a game about fishing, I pull this picture up. It's from a noodling competition in Oklahoma. And it's for listeners, as I try to get the link, is there a copy link? How do I do this?
Right click, copy link, paste.
There we go.
That's how Mac tells me.
Yeah, so it's this very cute person who has an extremely enormous fish. That just links you to the article.
I'm here for it. I see it.
There's copy image location. So it's this person with a giant fish slung over their shoulder and the biggest smile that I've ever seen on anyone. And like that's the kind of feel that I want to get with this game. Like taking a big step back and looking big picture, like I think that there's room in the conversation, and I think that there's value in all of these like these queer games that are like essentially like, hey, you and your lover are about to die. Express your true feelings to each other. Or like, hey, you're a queer ghost and you have to like go through and explore your death or something. Like all of these things I think are very cathartic and emotional, but like I don't feel like they have the impact on me that a piece of queer joy can produce. And so that I'm seeking with This Is a Game About Fishing to create opportunities of queer joy, but also still like be like, hey, the world's fucked up. You know, and I look at that picture every time I do it, and I want to make sure that those playbooks, to answer your original question, those playbooks all have tools in their tool belt to both be joyful and indulgent, but also kind of make a comment on the larger situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there is sort of this, I don't want to say trend, it's not a good word here for, but I think there is this focus on like the ending or the big moment or the climax of something, instead of like letting you, like it focuses on the peak of play versus like focusing on the plateaus of play, right? And I think sort of what you're talking about is that you want sort of that peak to maybe be like pushed down a little bit, and the peak can come from like the role play in of itself between that table. Mm-hmm. But I think there's something about like letting that experience ride in waves the whole time that you're sort of experiencing this game, which I think is very cool. It is definitely a style of design that I think this might be the first time I've come across in a game. I think also Gordy Murphy's Apotheosis also has a sort of like wave feeling to it. Mm-hmm. But I love it. I love that that is sort of the intent of letting the experience be the whole thing rather than like these key moments. Mm-hmm. The key moments kind of come from the role play of the players and like how they manipulate the systems and mechanics of this game and the prompts that you provide to give those peaks. Mm-hmm. I think it's great. I think it's really eye-opening for me in terms of like how I feel about my own designs.
Yeah, hell yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So this is sort of like a belonging outside belonging hack, right? As it says in the books. I made that up. But I think I've not read it per the recording of this episode yet. It keeps getting mentioned on the show, still hasn't hit my library. But I love this sort of mechanic of where you have an established, like, you basically let people make a move, right? Mm-hmm. Or enhance a move. And I love this tech because just to talk like about actual like mechanical writing, right? For a second on a game, on a show technically about that. But I love that you have sort of this fictional positioning start of a move and you let people write out the resolution of the move. Like what happens when this move is engaged? What does that look like at the tail end of it? And I think that's really, what do I want to say? Really powerful because it puts a lot of agency in the people for the people at the table, right? Because they can really craft their concept or their identity of this character by writing in their resolutions, right? Like when you lash out, people are scared of you, right? So like, not only is that mechanically effective, but now you've made a decision about the type of persona you're encapsulating for your playbook, right? I am an intimidating fighter. And maybe that can harm my relationships. Maybe that can help in like sticky situations. It has a lot of other layers to it when you decide that's the outcome of that move. Mm-hmm. And then you also have included like when you have cycled through all of your shared moves, you also add additional resolutions to those things. So it's always like this shifting character, like this growth. I think what I'm trying to say is that there's this like kind of character development baked into that system. Is that a belonging outside belonging thing? Is that something you sort of added on?
Yeah, so that's something that I kind of added on. I think the DNA from belonging outside belonging games or No Dice No Masters games are more in terms of the flavor build of the playbooks, which I think is the strongest suit of belonging outside belonging, where, you know, the building a playbook to me is very fun because I get to say like, here are all the options that you can use for like inspiring in your mind how you are going to use whatever the moves are for the playbook. And I think the moves are maybe secondary. Normally for belonging outside belonging or No Dice No Masters games, like you have a list of moves and then there's a token economy. So you can say for your strong moves, you will have to spend a token, but you can do things that are maybe, you know, more quote unquote narratively positive. So things like in Apocalypse World, I think there's a move that's just like shut someone down that spends a strong move. And then there's like weak moves where you'll gain a token that you can later spend that open you up for like quote unquote narrative complications. And I like those. I've never had an issue with those playing in belonging outside belonging games, but like I feel like, again, like it, similar to how I'm trying to like demonetize my experience in the industry of role playing games, like I want to deplatform the game's mechanics as like the focus of a game, and I want to maybe emphasize I want to like emphasize the quote unquote non mechanics part. And I put those in air quotes because I've had like multiple people recently tell me like everything in a game is a mechanic, even if it's just flavor text. Like, and I want to say I trust you to like play the game, positive or negative. Like I have faith in you that you understand narrative story beats and can run a game like that. The game here is not the token economy. The game here is creating a story together with your friends, and I trust that you know how to do that. I'll give you everything else that you need to do that, but I'm not going to tell you how.
Yeah. Wow. What a, like, what an interesting way to hack something, mm-hmm. right? Because, you know, for me, until literally right this second, I've always considered hacking like literally ripping an explicit mechanic from a game yeah. and remixing yeah. it, right? But this concept, this principle of design, and that you're just trying to capture the feeling or the experience and hack the experience of a mm-hmm. game is very interesting to me. Like, very, very interesting to me. I think I can even, like, think about some games that have done this. Like, not off the rip here. Mm-hmm. I can't name anything off the rip, but I know there's my mind is telling me you have read games that have done this exact thing you're talking about. You're just only being like awoken to the astral beast in this moment. Yeah. But wow, that's really interesting that was your intent behind mm-hmm. this in developing these explicit mechanics, mm-hmm. right? And I've also recently been hearing this as well. I think my interview with Nevin Holmes, which just came out per the recording of this episode, sort of opened my eyes to Adira Slattery, mm-hmm. who is also a great designer, who talks about both explicit and implicit mechanics. Explicit being actual like rules or procedures, and implicit being like flavor text, setting things, and how your voice parses down the information to the players mm-hmm. of the game. And there's definitely a ton of like implicit mechanics in here too, when you talk about communities and breaking the law and scoring big and going mm-hmm. fishing, and all of those things are both implicit and explicit. So I guess what I'm pointing to here is that you have effectively sort of merged the two. Like, I couldn't tell you, looking at your game, what is explicit from implicit, right? Like, and I think that's more of a trend of prompt-based games, like Belong Outside, Belong, No Dice, No Masters mm-hmm. things. I think Dream Askew and Dream Apart also do this, but again, not games I have read, not have hit my library yet, so I'm sorry if I fucked that up, creators of Dream Apart, Dream Askew. I will read the game, I promise. I am just first figuring out yeah. Twitter. But wow, like really, really big claps for this is a game about fishing, because I think you've executed on hacking experience, hacking the experience of a mm-hmm. game really well. So for what I know about mm-hmm. it, that's really cool. Like, great, great job. Hell yeah, Taylor.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Any final comments about like sort of the principles behind, like, you say you keep messing mm-hmm. with the game every now and again. Is there sort of like a principle that's keeping, like, is it, what's not sort of settling?
Yeah, I think the thing that's not settling for me with this is, I mean, we made a joke about it. There is no concrete image of the self, where it's like, and I say that as a joke, but also like totally true, is that like as I grow and change, this is a game about fishing is the thing that I think to me is maybe the thing that I'm most proud about in games. And like, I want to continue having it maintain that status in my mind. And the idea of finishing it means that it's static and mm-hmm, mm-hmm. it will, like, if I finish it and I say there is no more change to this game, then if I change and the game doesn't, there's a risk that I like look back and there's contradictions or things that don't ring, no longer mm-hmm. ring true. Mm-hmm. And so when I first started it, the first build of it was like a dice pool. And so you could have your skills, and the more points you had in a skill, the larger dice you would roll. And, you know, it also existed as a Powered by the Apocalypse game at one point, and then now into this kind of hack of Belonging Outside Belonging. And I think the thing that I want to close out on this is something that I'm just starting to get into now, which is having it not really exist as one static thing, but more of a, and I think this is very in theme of fishing, more of a tackle box. So like, it is an umbrella of tools that you can use to play games of this is a game about fishing, but like, depending on the gear that you choose to do it, your game is going to look a lot different mechanically than someone else's. Mm-hmm. So I want to write little modules and hire people to write little modules to like change the way that the rules work in different ways. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we talked about Tracy Barnett. I hired Tracy, and they wrote a very beautiful like lyric poem of this is a game about fishing that like if you want to play This Is a Game About Fishing with this poem, like, you should be able to. Mm-hmm. And I've hired people to come in and write playbooks that change how things work. And I want to add modules like stealing the scene setting of Questlandia, which I think is one of my coolest, like, one of the coolest things in RPGs is Questlandia. I think everyone should read it. I will never shut up about how much I love it. It's by Hannah Schaefer and Evan Roland. Again, that was one of the games that really got me in when I was first early starting to get into indie games. I love that game so much. So, like, stealing the scene setting from that, stealing, like, you know, I want it to be like, if people do want to roll dice, like, if the move resolution system is too vague, because, like, I definitely acknowledge that, like, again, my experience is different than, you know, than your experience, maybe, that, like, I don't have an issue improvising and role playing off of something that isn't very structured. But, like, if someone needs that, they shouldn't not be able to play my game. Mm-hmm. And so it's like trying to find, like, what are the modules that I want to make? What are the lures that I want to put into that tackle box so that, like, you can create this game experience with whatever you want to.
Wow, that's a very cool way to sort of push that design. And also, thank you for, like, sort of sharing the path of the game, too, because I think that's always helpful for listeners to show that, like, I mean, how, you know, I know we said that was the final, but, like, what has been, like, as a quick, like, how long has this game been in sort of, like, the, because the way you say it, it sounds to me like how I would phrase it or to parse it is, like, this is Taylor the game, right? Like, if Taylor shifts in conversation or thought or experience, then this game also shifts in those regards. How long have you been working on?
So the iteration that's up now that people can grab is like a year and a half, 2 years old, maybe. And I think this is the closest that I've gotten to like one static thing that I enjoy. But I've been tooling with it for the past like 5 years. So again, like it was the, like back in 2015, 2016, I had the dice pool thing, which worked then, but doesn't work now. And then from like 2017 to 19, it was the Powered by the Apocalypse game. And then 19 on, it's been how it looks now.
Amazing. Amazing. Great job, Taylor. Great job.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. It whips. I said it. So this is, as always, these last two bits, the first one being the trend section, Taylor. Hello. Welcome to your first lightning round. So as always, as I ask every guest in this show, in its current iteration of how I digest information to people, give
one of those things.
On. One of those things are true. Yeah. You decide. What are some trends that you are seeing that are blipping up in your social circles, your social commentaries, Twitter, Discords, friends of game design or anything like that you're seeing are really cool for the space? Maybe is there a trend out there that you find is being a little bit detractful and you want to caution people against approaching? Or what is a trend within yourself that you want to speak out that someone listening can just take and run with it?
I knew this question was coming and I did nothing to prepare for it. So, perfect. But yeah, I mean, again, machine gun, we're going to Wallace sound it. I think that the trend that I really appreciate is kind of like moving away from like the idea of, no, I'm going to start over. The trend that I really like and enjoy is these sort of like games that are mini games. So like Spindle Wheel is a great example of this. Stew Pot, Spindle Wheel by Sasha Renault, Stew Pot by Takuma Okada, and like the Firebrands framework by Vincent McKay Baker, where you are playing a bunch of smaller games in themselves. So Stew Pot is one that I think does a really great job. Stew Pot is one of my favorite games like ever written. The concept is you are a group of like adventurers who are settling down and like starting a tavern or like an inn. And as you play through the game, you trade your adventuring experience for innkeeper experience. And you can like repurpose a lot of these skills. But it's played through mini games. So it will rotate who is the spotlight character for each of these games. And they're short. They're like a fight breaks out. Who is the instigators and who is trying to stop the fight? Instigators, what do you do to escalate the situation? People who are trying to stop the fight, like how do you separate the people? And like you play through that and then it's done in like 15-20 minutes. And then you go on to the next game, which could be another fight, or it could be like you have a food critic who's visiting. You know, here's a game about collecting all the materials and essentially playing Chopped. Like I adore that because all of these things are small, encapsulated, very concentrated experiences. And for me, like, I can't focus on, like, 4 hours of the same thing. I can't play Dungeons & Dragons anymore. But what I can do is focus very briefly on these 20-minute mini games that all form a piece of the whole. And I think that Spindle Wheel does the same thing. Stewpot is, I believe, Stewpot is a hack of the Firebrains system. But yeah, I really want to see more mini games that come out of RPGs.
Do you think that this is also something, because I talked about this a bit with Aaron Lim quite a while ago, about the concept of like phased play, right? Like certain sections of the game's interactions have their own mechanics within the same game, right? Like Blades in the Dark is a perfect example of like you're getting two games for the price of one. This micro heist style game in your character sheets, and then this macro level crew sheet sort of experience, right? These downtime phase things. So in tandem with that, do you feel that like, because a lot of people hack Blades in the Dark, I guess, is sort of what I'm moving my conversation towards as I figure out words that are coming out of my mouth. But do you think that, like, because I feel like things like Blades in the Dark or Powered by the Apocalypse hacks are sort of getting trite, but they have they present a lot of, like, a game does not have to be one thing the full way through. So in this mini gaming, and I hear a lot of people love Firebrands. I actually recently read Firebrands. It finally hit my library after, what is this, like 26 episodes, whatever. I think I have 26 episodes on my podcast list three times. So I have to go through and alter that. But what I am asking here, Taylor, as I start all the way over in my brain, because it moves very fast. Do you think this product of mini game design is, or phase play design, I think those things are interchangeable here, is part of what I was trying to say. Do you think that is a result of like traditional gaming, how like figuring out how to play with the adult 9-to-5 schedule, like people who are doing day jobs and want to get together and hang out, but they don't want to learn the complexities of D&D, or they don't have like 4 to 6 hours to like rip through an adventure in their own speed. Do you think it's a result of that, like trying to parse down the amount of time play is actually engaged in?
I think there's correlation. I don't know if there's causation, where it's I think that phase play games or mini game games definitely play well with folks for whom that's a concern. But like, I've also played, like at Big Bad Con, I played a game of Stewpot for 4 hours. Like that was a big chunk of time that we could devote time and energy to. I don't necessarily know that I have a firm grasp on like why those games exist or like what the design intent behind them was. But yeah, no, I think that they play well together, those two ideas.
Yeah, I find it really, like, I'm a big fan of phase play because I like that it's also like a pacing thing. Like I'm kind of like a story structure junkie in that, like, I like researching those sorts of things, those sorts of architectures. And I find it interesting that, like, when I think about D&D, it kind of has two phases. It doesn't talk about it, but D&D has two phases. It has role play and it has combat. And the combat portion is real long. And then role playing helps break up that pacing. So, and what I'm saying is I think it's intrinsically wanted by players at the table. And so when there are games that help facilitate that pacing, say, hey, when you're done with doing this, take a second, take five, look through your character sheets and start making some faction decisions on your downtime mm-hmm. phase, right? Like, take a breather from having to, like, role play fast, right? I think there's also room for experimentation about, like, slow and fast role play. Like, you can be a little bit more methodical about what you want, right? You can, like, retcon some things. I heard someone, there's a D&D actual play / audio drama called Dark Dice that I listen to. Great podcast by Fool and Scholar Productions. But basically what they do, instead of having you listen to them roll D20s and engage in combat, they do a lot of, like, narrative skill mm-hmm. checks and role play. And then the GM, who is also, like, the designer of a lot of the shows for that audio drama company, goes back and redoes exposition as, like, a voiceover. So it parses down a 3-hour, like, actual play into, like, half hour episodes mm-hmm. because he basically narrates the combat to an ending point rather than taking the turn mm-hmm. chronology to figure that out. And so the reason I bring that up is that I've heard people, like, homebrew, I think Adam Bell and me talked about this in, like, mm-hmm. private a while ago about how, why, maybe it was on the Colin show, like, sort of retcon mm-hmm. it. Like, you don't need to talk about how many divine smites the paladin hit someone with. Just talk about what did that combat feel mm-hmm. like after it's all said and done. Like, talk about the whole thing. Like, okay, we engaged in the fight, and what it really went down to being is, like, we burst into the room, we hit them with a bunch of flash and fireballs and pizzazz, mm-hmm. and that's it. Like, that was the result of what was happened. So I think what I like about you bringing up minigame games, bringing up phase play, is that it helps with pacing. It helps consider pacing in, like, a role play fashion. I think it also, like, delivers different cognitive mm-hmm. loads. Right. I think it lets you, like, reset and sort of palate cleanse yourself mm-hmm. as well. And I think that's very, very cool. I'll have to check out Stewpot. I'm going to write that down.
Yeah. I super love Stewpot. Yeah.
Any additional trends that you want to seek about, Taylor?
A trend that frustrates me. Normally, I don't like mm-hmm. to talk about trends that I'm frustrated with, but, like, I think this one has mm-hmm. some value is people. Yeah, I feel like they're missing the story for the trees, if I can mix my metaphor here. In whenever we say, like, oh, you know, this game was great, we barely touched the dice, and people talking about that as like a bad experience, but I think it's maybe, like, mm-hmm. a misappropriated view of what an experience was going, like, what that experience was. Because, like, I feel mm-hmm. like no rules collaborative storytelling can be a game. And by mm-hmm, saying, like, mm-hmm. oh, it's not great if they say we didn't touch the dice, we still had, you know, we told this great story, we had a great game, we didn't touch the dice, that, like, there are unwritten rules in collaborative storytelling that are as much a game as, you know, making sure that you're, you know, getting your 2d6 in. Like, and I see the merit in the argument that, like, if you're playing a game, you should be there playing the game. And if you're going to tell a story with your friends, you should be going and telling a story with your friends. But, like, my argument mm-hmm. here is with that trend, like, being frustrated with the trend of that argument being passed around in the discourse, is that, like, telling a story with your friends is play and is a game. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I don't know. I don't have a full and developed thesis, but it bugs me every time I see that.
No, this is, like, I am on that spectrum of people who are like, if you're there to play the game, mm-hmm. play the game, right? Like, that's how I engage in role plays. Like, I'm here to play D&D. I'm here to play Blades of Dark. I'm here to play Stewpot, right? Like, that's what we came to do today. I like rolling dice. I like the click clack. I like engaging in mechanics. I come from a video game background, but recently, I've learned about, in a conversation with Ava Islam, mm-hmm. we talked about the sort of, like, FKR side of role play or game design. It stands
for, I was going to say, I'm not familiar with this.
yeah. Freed. Jeremy, edit this out. Game design. Mm-mm-mm-mm-mm-mm-mm-mm. Where is it? Freed. Oh, it is on my phone. Stand by, Taylor. I just want to make sure I get this word right because I don't just want to say FKR. Yeah, yeah. Let's see. Search.
Should I just search in the Brain Trust Discord for FKR?
No, I actually have my own Discord where we talked about this, which you are more than welcome to join now that you're an, I mean, you were always welcome, but now that you're an alumni, it's kind of demanded of you. Hello, connect. Freed. Why won't it search my messages
Free
on my phone?
Free Kriegspiel Revolution.
Thank you. There it is. Power of the internet. We're back in it, Jeremy. Claps. So, yeah, would you say that for me one more time, Taylor?
Is it Free Kriegspiel Revolution?
Yes. That's the FKR sort of culture of game design in which it is really just like the meat of it is that you're just designing a character by writing down like 2 to 3 traits or qualities. It might be something like really good at fighting, really good at tying your shoes, really good at making a cup of coffee. And then you just go, you just start having like negotiation style role play where like you're engaging with the fictional environment, you're putting up these theoreticals, and then you see how those traits or qualities help adjust those things. And so, you know, I was also the mind like, are you playing a game or are you just playing improv at the table when you're not engaging with the die, you know, getting your 2d6 in, right? And not to say that I was closed-minded about that experience, but one wasn't the other. And I think that discourse sort of inertias or orbits around like D&D. I think that the biggest thing is like, that's not how you play D&D. You play D&D by rolling a d20 and engaging with those pass-fail mechanics. And if you didn't do it, you weren't playing D&D, you were doing something else. Sort of that like gatekeepy sphere. I think that's like in, because I see that similar conversation, I think it comes from those sort of like gatekeeper spaces as well that like leak out into other thought trains, right? And so I totally vibe with what you're putting out there of like, hey, you know, we always have to ask ourselves, what is play? What is actually play? Is that engaging with the D20 or is that engaging with fiction and narrative, or is it engaging with thought experiments that you enact upon when we talk about when we talk about character bleed and playing LARPs and that's those sort of experiences as well, right? I think that's a really cool thing that you brought up, and I think it's sort of like a re-examination of the self. I think it's definitely good to put it out there because like, oh, I've also been that person who's like, you're not playing if you're not dicing. But is that actually true?
Yeah. And I'm going to
Go ahead. No, you. You're the guest.
Okay. I'm going to compare it to music again and being like, if we're thinking about that sort of conversation, like it's kind of like if I were to play a piece of classical music, like if I were to be in an orchestra and play Tchaikovsky and I said, yeah, that concert went great, I didn't look at the music once, that would be bad.
Yeah.
Like I cannot imagine a concert in which I was not asked to leave the musical group for not looking at my Tchaikovsky music, you know? But like if I'm playing in a jazz group, I might get bars and chords rather than musical notes on the page. And I can still look at that and be like, okay, well here I'm playing in the key of A. And it's up to me to decide what notes I get to choose to play, as long as it's in the key of A and kind of in the same rhythm as everyone else. And if I say, oh yeah, that concert went great, I didn't look at the music once, like that's a different conversation than the Tchaikovsky experience. And then even further, if you're looking into music like free jazz or like avant-garde, like if you're looking at Machine Gun, like I will admit I'm not familiar with the tablature of Machine Gun. But like if you're just there and you're creating a wall of sound, like it doesn't, I can do whatever I want with my instrument, regardless of key, regardless of note, regardless of rhythm sometimes. And like creating an experience and a piece of art there. And using that example, if I say, yeah, that concert was great, I didn't look at the music once, it's like, of course you didn't. Why would you? Like, I want to still say that there's value in that kind of conversation of like you know, how much do you engage with dice mechanics, with, you know, whatever, versus how much is like going off of your own collaborative storytelling is, you know, I say this a lot, good and bad don't mean anything, but it's a different conversation depending on like what the game is and what the games that you're playing. So like, I say all of that to be like, I really respect like people who are like, hey, I'm here to play the game and we're going to follow these mechanics because that's the experience that we're looking for. But I also want to push back mm-hmm. against the trend of like a lot of people kind of maligning that response to not touching the dice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I think what it ultimately points to, what I feel in what we're talking about ultimately points to is like, it just has to be an agreed upon mm-hmm. structure for the people at the table, right? Not any onlookers or like people you're telling after mm-hmm. the fact. It's like, hey, we all agreed to show up to play D&D today and I want a Divine Smite thing. So can we
right,
roll
let's
something,
do it.
Right? Versus another table that like the structure is... Mm-hmm. Hey, I just had this character concept, and can we just sort of like
mm-hmm.
hash out some prompts, like belong outside belonging, or something like that, and just talk it out? And like, yes, that's the structure we agreed upon, so let's engage in that, right? So I think it's for the people at the table, it's about the structure you to facilitate the role play, mm-hmm. right? But all versions are valid role play, just as all versions of those beautiful music examples you gave us are music, because you agreed upon, like, today I want to listen to freeform jazz, no matter how crazy that sounds to other people, right? Because to you it is still yeah. music, because it still engages in the components of music play, whether that is a orchestra and symphony or just a wall of mm-hmm. brass and string and mm-hmm. keys, right? And percussion. So I think that's very good. I think that's a very good analogy you put up there, Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
Lightning round, TLDR tip. Taylor, usually I roll dice here,
yes.
but I think that I am slowly, because I keep rolling fours, if you've been listening yeah. to the show, I use different dice every time. So I am now trying to structure more of my tips to get in a particular person's expertise or field, because I think that's more beneficial than asking a mm-hmm. random question. So... Taylor, in sort of, I know this is probably going to be really tied to your personal perspective mm-hmm. and experience, but, and not every game is made for every individual, but I am someone who likes to eat up a lot of different things. So in sort of thinking about mm-hmm. queer play, right, I had Paulino Caputo on a while back. We talked about their experiences with trying to engage in their perspectives and their experiences and getting queer play out into the field. I think Adira does very similar things as well with her works. And how can – this might be like a two-parter. I don't want to ask what defines queer play. That's not the question I'm trying to get here. But that's like the yeah, thing yeah. that keep like, is this the simplest way to parse that out? No, it is not, because it's not the correct way. But what is sort of like, how do we support mm-hmm. queer play, right? I think in both, and the reason it's two parts, like both in the vein is being a queer person, mm-hmm. which I am not, mm-hmm. but you know, then I think about what is it to be straight, and am I actually like in my own way queer, yeah, yeah. right? And this isn't the like I don't want to say it to diminish anyone else's like transition of a queer experience, but I'm like, you know, what is this fluidness? How do I support yeah. that? How do I, you know, I am a person who by traditional means is straight, but I don't like think in that
sure.
context. I just think that my attraction is towards female presenting, right? So. Like, how do we support queer play in our role play, right? And regardless of mechanics,
yeah.
right? Like, how do we come to the table? How do we come to an understanding? Like, how can I be a person, mm-hmm. right, to support actual plays, streams, podcasts, mm-hmm. like those sorts of things? How do I come to the table and present a character that helps facilitate that environment? Or from your experience of designing, how do we send a message mm-hmm. with our – or not send a message, but how do we parse that experience mm-hmm. in a way that doesn't have to be for traditionally straight people, but is more of like, what do you think has been successes for you in getting queer play out into the field? Does that make sense? That's a very long question, but I wanted to make sure that I was as muddily clear as possible.
Yeah. I ask a similar question on Game Closet to every one of my guests. I say, if you were to give someone one piece of advice to make your games more queer, what piece of advice would that be? And every guest gives me a unique answer, and I really enjoy all of them. So I'll run through like the highlight reel of the pieces of advice that stick with me, like for a ways after the interview. And that's not to say that if I don't mention your answer that it doesn't stick with me, because again, I love every single answer that I get to that question. But
yeah, but right, exactly. Minutes, so like, give me the highlights,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So Lucian.
Yeah. It's my fault.
Khan says to make space to remember queer joy. And that answer really, really stuck with me in terms of like, if you are looking to write a queer game, remember the full breadth of the queer experience. And I think that there's a trend in a lot of media that's made both by queer and straight people to focus on the struggle of queer existence, to say, you know, hey, these are the issues that queer people deal with on a day-to-day basis. Like, I'm using this as an example to illustrate the trend and not as a way to detract from the game, because I do think that it is a genuinely beautiful game. Together We Write Private Cathedrals by Ben, I can't remember Ben's last name for some reason, Ben Roswell.
Yes.
Together We Write Private Cathedrals is a gorgeous game about having to hide your queerness in society so that you can, you know, essentially be stealth as straight. And it's about looking at historic relationships between people who we may now today contextualize as being in a queer relationship, but either, you know, back then we didn't have the language, or there's not a lot of existing evidence that like really concretely says, here is who I am and here's how I identify. That is to be very reductive, is a bummer to think about. And again, I love this game to death. I wish more people would read it, and I wish it would be talked about more. But that kind of experience is not the sole experience of myself as a queer person. That is for sure a very strong sense, because a lot of queer history has been kind of in the shadows or in stealth for a lot of safety reasons. But like, another piece of my queer identity is that like, it's one of my favorite things about who I am. Like, my being queer brings me so much joy every single day. And the joy that I get from my queer friends, the joy that I get from, you know, talking about being queer, about reading about being queer, about, you know, any sort of that experience brings me more happiness than a lot of other things can do. And so it's something that I do have to remind myself also to make space for that joy and to be intentional about showing the queer magic of existing. Vidicia Valetti, past guest of Game Closet and also Draw Your Dice, Vidicia Valetti said, think about your hierarchies, and if you can, get rid of them. There's a piece of queer theory that is all about like, you know, the boxes that we think about things, the way that we think about things in terms of their labels is a disservice to the things themselves. And hierarchies are a natural way to like think about things. And so if you say there is no one important part of my game, or there's like, if you're talking about a hack, like there is no essential Powered by the Apocalypse thing. Like, there are a bunch of things in Powered by the Apocalypse. There's a bunch of things in Belonging, Outside Belonging, but not one thing makes those things that thing. There is no hierarchy of existence. And so when you think about your games, like, think about that mechanically, but then also think about, like, what is the important activity or, like, practice that you're doing in your games, and split that up. Like, mess with that. There's also a lot of people that say, like, don't be afraid to do it, or just like, just do it is a common advice that we get a lot. Like, if you're making a game, like, and you think, should I do XYZ, do it, you know, go for it. So I guess those are the like three big things that I would recommend in terms of like how to think about queer games and, you know, how to get them out into the field.
Do you think as well, how, just sort of like for me as a person who supports, how do I make, I mean, I can't, I don't,
I don't think I have the capabilities to write a queer game or even write queer components. And I don't mean that like I wouldn't want to try. I mean that as in that if I did it, it would probably be a disservice to the conceptual existence of that space, right? I feel like as kind as I could be at executing it, it would be like a C minus in comparison to like other things, right? So how can we support, maybe not necessarily queer play, right? I'm not trying to invent queer play, but how can I bring queer identity, right? How can I help allow fluidity in my game design to support those persons that exist inside of my setting, inside of my mechanics, inside of or what are your ideas?
I guess is the
more tame question.
My ideas on that are many and varied, but I think back to I was on a podcast called the My Gay Agenda podcast, and one of the questions that they asked was like, what's one message that you want to tell straight people? And I think that my answer there, I think, applies to here. You know, anytime someone straight says like, how do I make my games more welcoming, or how do I represent queerness in my games? Like my answer there is straight people can do queer shit. Like you can play, you can role play as queer character. Like, this isn't me giving you permission, like whatever. And it is also not a hand wave to, if you do these things poorly, you know, you're free of consequence because Taylor said so. Yeah. But it's like you can do all of the things that you see queer people do in their games, in your games. Like, we don't own the patent on replacing your gender box with your, with a box that says pronouns. Or like Sleepaway does this really well in that, like, it gives you abstract thoughts for gender. So like you could say like, my gender is a rusted sword, or my gender is like a piece of moss growing on an old log. Like, look at what queer people are doing with their queer games and like some of the conversations that are happening there, and like, know that you, those are tools that can be in your toolbox as well.
You, so I'm asking Taylor, not like the queer ethos, those sort of like, cause I've seen some people, or have heard some people, like, and no one in like my close circles or like understanding circles, but sort of like people I've had in my life that look at those, like you said, how Sleepaway does sort of like gender personifications. Do you feel like, you don't feel like those things are insulting in any way? Or, I mean, I'm sure there could be versions of them that are insulting. Yes, I totally agree with that, or want to recognize that. Not that you said something to that effect, but do you feel like those things are easily done poorly, or is it, I don't know. I just feel like being compared to an item has rubbed some people the wrong way, right? Like, no matter how sort of poetic you are about it. How do you feel about that? That one specifically?
I mean, like, I guess the thing, looking at it from the opposite way, like I tell straight people you can do queer things. And I also tell queer people like, you can do things that you're worried about doing because it's a trope that straight people do it. Like, I think a while back about telling a friend, and I don't know if I have permission to share the story, so I'm going to keep it anonymous. Like, telling a friend who came to me like, hey, I'm thinking about this with, you know, a story or like this actual play that I'm doing, and I'm worried that it falls into the like bury your gaze tropes, with which, if anyone's not familiar, it is a trope among media often produced by straight people where the queer folks will get together and then immediately die, where it's very often assumed like, hey, this death is because you are queer. And so I tell my friend, like, you know what, just because this is a trope that straight people do, doesn't, like, you're not straight. You are not bound by this. That's their problem and not yours. And I say that to be like, on one hand, yes, straight people do all these queer things. Like, you can have open-ended gender stuff in your games. You can do all these things, but like, so can queer people, and queer people can mess it up as often as straight people, and queer people can do all these things. And like, just the fact that like, whether you're queer or you're straight does not preclude you from fucking up. And it also doesn't preclude you from doing it really, really well. Like, I don't know personally how Brandon Conway identifies, but Masks is a very queer game to me as a queer person. And thinking about like, this is ostensibly written by a straight person who gets it in a lot of ways about like how identity is built, how other people tell you who you are and how you respond to that and how you create mm-hmm. yourself. Masks is, to me, a very queer experience. So if someone who is looking to do right by a queer audience in games, I would say, you know, do something that feels authentic to you and your goals there with mm-hmm. the idea that you could fuck up, but you could also make something really mm-hmm. amazing.
Mm-hmm. I think what I want to say, like what I'm thinking about as you're talking about this, as you're giving sort of me this advice, because, you know, shameless mention here, everyone. I do this show because I want to learn how to game design, and you all get to benefit from that for free. So that's the secret. That's the secret Draw Your Dice sauce. But what I think about is, like, it's not just about, like, gender specifically, but it's more about identity mm-hmm. generally. And what I mean by that, like, just this is just me, like, kind of digesting what you're talking about here. And I think there's something about figuring out, like, who you
are. Oh, I think you froze. Oh, no.
How you can work that into the game of, like, how can you make a person feel like they've captured who they are, I think is something to... Oh, did I lose my connection? Hello, Taylor. Stand by.
Did I freeze or did you freeze? Is the question.
No.
Hello, you're back.
Jesus. That's my sponsor, AT&T, saying... What I was saying is that I think that there is an idea behind identity generally, mm-hmm. in that, like, are you facilitating someone to truly come to the table with their concept in mind and make that mm-hmm. happen, right? Like, are you providing the tools to let someone be expressive rather than keeping to a limited set of options, mm-hmm. like male, female, you know, dragonborn, half elf? Like, there's so much more to a person. So allow people to express those mm-hmm. details, right? Like, how do you present? What sort of relationships are you looking towards, right? Like, how can you write those things down on a paper, put them in a document, and help lead people to say, like, what are you interested in? How do you want to interact with this fictional space with your avatar, your vessel, mm-hmm. right? So in just sort of talking about, like, listening to you, listening to what you're sort of, like, laying on me and thinking about the things that you're saying, I think a big, for me, as a straight person, as a traditionally straight person, it's about providing the chance for identity mm-hmm. molding, right? Like, and I mean that in, like, as fractal as a way as possible, not just, like, two or three options or, like, what kind of clothes are you wearing? What's mm-hmm. your hair like? And that's it. Like, it's so much, identity is so much mm-hmm. more than that. And I think thinking in that context could help inform my designs better to facilitate more queer identity mm-hmm. in games, in my games, my non-existent games at this point. But one day we will get a game out there, Jeremy, I swear. Yeah. Does that make sense? Like, is what I'm saying, is that something that you feel is, like, a good, like distillation of what you're saying here?
I think so. I think there's one level in which you could ask, how do I let my players represent who they are and tell the stories about who they are?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that there's another mm-hmm. level, which, and again, to borrow from Vidicia, like there is no hierarchy between these two levels. They exist separately, you know, mm-hmm. laterally. There's another level where it's mm-hmm. like, what is the play experience of this, and how can we, like, how does the play of this queer game, rather than how do I represent my queer person in it? I think it's mm-hmm. the conversation is different depending on who you are. The conversation between us as individual creators is a lot different between, should I be focusing on how people can represent themselves, or should I be focusing on the play experience, you know, creating a play experience that speaks to queer people, than it is for, 'cause like one of my pet peeves is the Queer as a Three-Sided Dice panel at Gen Con every year, which is usually hosted by like Green Ronin or Paizo, and it's like a bunch of company mm-hmm. HR representatives or game designers talking about how their game is really gay because in one adventure you can play a gay farmer. And so like I
no.
I don't want to detract from like the fact that yes, it is great in these large, you know, quote unquote AAA companies that there is queer representation in some of their published materials. But I do not think that those experiences speak to what I'm looking for as a queer tabletop role player. What I'm looking for is more of these Together We Write Private Cathedrals, Sleepaway, Stew Pot, you know, mm-hmm. these games that in their experience themselves are queer more than you can play a queer character in them.
That's good stuff, and I'm glad that you brought up that panel mm-hmm. too. I think it's like don't just label a small part of mm-hmm. your game with the one word you know from the LGBTQ like acronym, right? It's so much more than that. So yeah. I'm glad you brought
and
that
I will
up.
Say
Thank
like
you.
Those panels are great. They allow people who are queer in those larger companies a platform to celebrate that queerness. Like, they're run by, mm-hmm. you know, Crystal Frazier is usually there. And, you know, I think that generally I like her a lot. Tanya DePass has been on those, and I love Tanya so much. Yeah, they're not always not great, but there is more than one of them where I left more disappointed than I was expecting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Good. Great. Good. Well, we are at yes. the two-hour mark. We're at the Taylor. It is Saturday as we record, and there is so much more yes. Saturday to be had. I want to thank you so much for being here today. You have brought so many cool things to my mind, so many cool things that have really, like, truly molded me as a designer in this moment. Where can people find you? Where can they get in touch with you? Where can they buy your things again? You mm-hmm. know, self-promo plugs, all these links that Taylor is going to share with us will be down below in the show notes for your
Absolutely.
Access.
Absolutely, yeah. I am on Twitter, at Leviathan Files. You can grab any number of games at riverhousegames.itch.io. The thing that I would really appreciate everyone doing is listening to Game Closet, an informal chat show with all sorts mm-hmm. of queer and LGBT plus amazing folks in this space. And check out the people who I have there on as guests, because they're all wonderful. And you can also listen to the RSS Defiant to listen to us talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Get the inside taste of who Taylor is at any given moment. Once again, thank you so much, Taylor. For everyone who's listening out there, I have been molded today, and I hope that you have as well. I love listening to these sorts of conversations and really, you know, clamming up and getting my nose into it. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Taylor. And we will see you in the next episode. Say bye to the people, Taylor.
Bye to the people, Taylor.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, that's a wrap. Thank you for taking the time to sit down and hang out with Taylor and I. We really appreciate it. You can find links and resources down below in the show notes, such as getting in touch with Taylor or other episodes with similar topics. If you want to be a part of the conversation, please come and join the community Discord server. Also, make sure to subscribe to the Draw Your Dice Patreon, where you can get access to early releases of episodes from as soon as we interview. Thanks again for stopping by, and as always, I will catch you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.